Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum, and chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to turn the meeting over to Fran Johns, who organized this panel on Women at Risk, What's Ahead for Reproductive Rights.
Thanks. Thanks, Bill. Is this working? Okay, because I need all the help I can get. I'm just going to introduce my panelists very briefly, and then each of us will speak for a couple of minutes. We want to spend as much time as we can on questions, because we'd like to know what you are interested in finding out. And if we can answer the questions, it'll be a bonus. So, starting at the right is Chanel Matthews. Chanel is the communications strategist for the ACLU right around the corner of Northern California and is our energy person, and she and I are both missing some of our energy from having some kind of awful bug, but whichever of us has a voice that lasts will be the speaker last. And next to Chanel is Scotty McLennan, who has just announced his retirement from being dean for religious life at Stanford so he can hang out and just teach, which is what he likes to do most. And what I like most is that he is the model for Doonesbury's Dude of God, and he even looks like Dude of God. So that's my favorite introduction for Scotty. And then next to me is Lisa Lindeleff, who is a longtime member of the board of NARAL Pro-Choice America. She is now on the board of NARAL Pro-Choice America Foundation. And if I get this wrong, as I did once in the book, she will correct me. And Lisa is here to share a whole bunch of data with us and her story as an activist. So I'm going to turn the microphone back to Chanel and let her start off with a little bit about what she is doing.
Thank you, Fran. Hi, everybody. Thank you, Bill. As Fran mentioned, I have quite a bug, so I have to apologize in advance for my voice. Thank you all so much for being here. I'm really glad to see some men in the audience, which is a rare sight at Repro events. But thank you for coming. I feel like I should shake each one of your hands after this is done. So today our focus is on the issue of women's reproductive rights, and just for full transparency, we did have somebody who was interested in speaking from a pro-life perspective on the panel. Fortunately, we are already set, so we hope that, you know, they're in the audience today. Maybe they are here in the audience today. And, you know, our hope is to inform the audience about the current state of reproductive health rights and justice. As Fran mentioned, I am from the ACLU of Northern California, who's committed to reproductive health rights and justice and ensuring that everybody has equal protection under the law. I also want to mention that here in California, we are celebrating a victory last week. California is the first state, the only state this year, to expand abortion access by passing the Early Abortion Access Bill, AB 154, authored by Assemblymember Tony Atkins. And we will be now allowing certified nurse midwives, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants to perform early abortions in the first trimester. So it's a very big victory. We hope to be a model for the rest of the country, though we do know we have a progressive legislature or progressive legislature in other states don't. So we'll see what happens come 2014. Where at the ACLU, we work from a reproductive justice perspective, which is different from repro rights because it takes into account the many circumstances people are facing when they need access to abortion care, which includes race and class, income level, geography. One of the issues that AB 154 will be helping to reconcile is an issue of access. So people assume that people in California have access to abortion providers when in fact only 52% of California counties actually have an accessible provider, so allowing nurse midwives and physician's assistants to perform early abortions will help close the access gap for California women and families. We're very excited about that. And Perilous Times, which is Fran's book, and we're very excited that she wrote it because it brought us all here today, actually talks about issues of race and class and including a justice framework and reproductive rights so that we are inclusive of all people, no matter their race, socioeconomic status, background, geographical location, and other constructs that tend to really keep women and families from being able to take the best care of themselves and to thrive. So without further ado, I will pass it on to Lisa.
Thank you, Chanel. I can do this. So I'm a lifelong activist of many stripes. I'm a trained lawyer, a trained psychotherapist. I don't do either one of those things anymore. And I've had a very interesting career. But I've been involved with the pro-choice and reproductive rights movement since before Roe, from the days in high school when I saw classmates of mine disappear and not come back to school. As choice gradually and now increasingly has become threatened by restrictions, and this is not just access to abortion, it's the whole range of reproductive rights choices, this is all being weakened by restrictions. It's been threatened by restrictions that are designed to weaken the Roe decision without actually undoing it. And about 15 years ago, I decided it was time to put some serious time and resources into this issue. The Pro-Choice Coalition has a number of admirable partners, including Chanel's ACLU. But I opted to start working with NARAL Pro-Choice America because I believe that we are the political leader of the pro-choice movement. That's what we do. And with our combined state and federal presence, we are uniquely positioned to lead the fight to protect a woman's right to choose. So now, some quick facts. Right now, we're in the middle of an unprecedented onslaught of anti-choice litigation in the states, and that is where the battle has moved. This session, there have been 307 anti-choice bills in state legislatures. Some are directly related to abortion. Some are, as I mentioned, related to other reproductive rights, conscience refusal clause issues, pharmacy refusal, that sort of thing. 43 anti-choice measures have been enacted this year. The House of Representatives just passed a 20-week abortion ban, and Marco Rubio is poised to do the same now that he's back at work. And as you probably know, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case coming from Massachusetts concerning protesters' access to clinics. The scenario for 2014, 36 governorships at stake, as well as key Senate races and all of the House. The job, we feel, is to hold politicians accountable, to reverse the trend by capturing stories, to highlight bad actors and the people who represent themselves as believing one thing and not necessarily doing the same. What do we do at NARAL? We elect pro-choice leaders via our PAC and our electoral work. We protect choice in the states at the federal and state level. We work to improve access to birth control, emergency conception, contraception, and legal abortion services. We stop threats to choice in the courts, and in the particular instance of the foundation, on which board I serve now, we work to educate and propose policy, which is not directly political work, but can influence political campaigns and politicians who come to us for our support. So that's a thumbnail of me, and now Scotty.
Thanks. I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister and an attorney, and in the interest of full disclosure, my wife and I have been long-term members of NARAL.
Thank you.
And I'm on the board of the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California, which Chanel serves as communications strategist. And Fran was kind enough to include in her book material on abortion from an article that I wrote. But I want to make it clear that I respect the views of religious people who are opposed to abortion because they truly consider it to be murder. And I personally would join them on this issue if I thought that an embryo or a fetus is fully a human being or a person. And yet it's very important to understand that this has never been a settled question within Christianity or Judaism. There are large segments of the Judeo-Christian world that historically and currently see the embryo or fetus as potential human life, but not as fully human until birth, or at some stage in fetal development well past conception. My personal religious understanding is that human life or personhood begins at birth. And let me briefly trace some Judeo-Christian religious history for you, especially since the Bible is appealed to by so many anti-abortion Christians. There's nothing explicitly said in the Bible about induced abortion. Zero. The Jewish position starts with Exodus 21:22. When people who are fighting injure a pregnant woman so that there's a miscarriage, and yet no further harm follows, the one responsible shall be fined, paying as much as the judges determine. So only a fine, no punishment for homicide. And on the basis of this passage, the rabbis argued in the Talmud that a fetus is not considered an Adam, a human, and has no legal standing as a person. Killing a fetus is not murder, and it's not treated that way. And the mainstream Jewish position historically and today is that human life or personhood begins at birth when we take our first breath. For most of the history of the Catholic Church, one did not become a human being or a person until well after conception. St. Augustine in the 4th century adopted the Aristotelian belief that the human soul doesn't enter the fetus until 40 to 90 days after conception. And the apostolic constitutions of the late 4th century allowed abortion if it was done before the human soul entered. Pope Innocent III in the 13th century held that the soul enters the body at the time of quickening, when a prospective mother first feels movement of the fetus. And when Pope Gregory XIV affirmed the quickening test for ensoulment in 1591, he set the time for it as 116 days into pregnancy, or the 16th week. The great reversal came with Pope Pius IX in 1869. He assumed ensoulment at conception, and by 1917, church canon law was revised, and Pius's position has been maintained by the Catholic Church ever since. The U.S. Supreme Court, in its 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, used religious references to explain, in part, why the word person, as used in the U.S. Constitution, does not include the unborn. Quote, "There has always been strong support for the view that human life does not begin until live birth. This was the belief of the Stoics. It appears to be the predominant attitude of the Jewish faith. It may be taken to represent a large segment of the Protestant community." Close quote. I'm personally part of that large Protestant community that believes that human life and personhood begins at birth. And some of my feelings admittedly may stem from connotations of the word birth and conception within the church. We speak of Esau and others in the Bible as having a birthright, not a conception right. After a strong religious experience, we may say we've been born again, not conceived again. Various biblical characters speak of the land of their birth. We celebrate birthdays, including Christmas, as the birth of Jesus. I'm also personally compelled by the notion that it's the breath of life that makes us full human beings, and I'll personally never forget the sight of each of my children emerging into the world, seemingly blue and lifeless, being struck on their back by the doctor, taking their first breath, becoming ruddy-colored as they first began crying and crying their way into life. Now they were tiny people. Now they had joined the human race, not before.
Those of you who know me, and I think I've got friends out there, will understand that I surround myself with smart people, and it always works. So thank you, all of you. So what the reason I'm here is because of this book. The publicist says, hold up the book. Always hold up the book. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. All that kind of stuff. But the book is the focus of the panel, because it was the inspiration of the panel. And I also hope, my hope for the book is to put a face on some of the women who are involved in this business of abortion, and to take all of the focus off of the fetus. I am like Scotty. I want to say up front that I really do respect the views of those who believe that life begins at conception, and we must therefore make abortion never happen. And I don't, if I knew any way to make that true, I would go for it, because I would like never to see abortion happen again. But I'm afraid it always will. The only answer I have thought of is the possibility that we could round up all of the men who are at the cause of unintended pregnancy in any one given day, and somehow implant uteruses in them and have them all give birth. And then I think, and that's the only answer I have come up with, and it may not be really good. But I don't want to make too light of it, because it is not a simple thing. It is never an easy decision. It's always complex, and it's always involves more than just the woman and the fetus. And that's why I feel so strongly that we have to defend the women. So I started the book 3 years ago as initially just thinking I would record some of the stories of those of us who had pre-Roe abortions, a lot of us, because we're dying off. And I very quickly learned that the same stories are happening today. And I got a lot of help from NARAL, from ACLU folks, from Physicians for Reproductive Choice and Health. It's now Physicians for Reproductive Health. Why did they drop the choice? And so one thing would lead to another. A physician would say, well, you really ought to hear the story of this young woman I saw yesterday. And I'd say, well, okay, can you give her my phone number and if she wants to talk to me? And so I would be walking around the Presidio listening to these people who so often sounded like children, and half the time they were, telling stories that would just break your heart. And I think there were probably people all over who were wondering about that crazy lady walking around the Presidio in tears, talking on her cell phone, but that was me. But I want to say about listening to the other side, I want to tell you about a woman who was at a reading that I had. It was a private party in Mill Valley, and maybe a couple dozen, mostly women. And one of the women took me aside at the end, and she said, you must not lump us all into one basket, because I'm a lifelong Catholic, I'm a Republican, and I had an abortion. And I said, oh, my goodness, did I lump you into one basket? And she said, well, no, you didn't, but everybody else does. And it makes me think that we've got to find some way not to lump each other into impenetrable baskets. I have a good example of how difficult this is in the person of my son, who can't talk about the book. He told his sister, he said, well, Sandy, it's murder. So we have never talked about it. His wife works at a pregnancy crisis center, and I adore this child as much as my own. And I hope in her pregnancy crisis center they don't call you a murderer if you say, well, I really want to consider abortion. But I did ask her, and she said, well, we don't counsel about abortion. So what I want to do is find some way that people like, I can talk to Jill. She will listen to me. She came to a reading, and I can listen to her, and maybe we can find some answers. But as long as we're just shouting at each other, I don't think we will. So that's why I'm here. I wanted to to record some of the stories. And Bill, are you collecting questions? If you don't write down questions, we'll just keep on talking. So you might want to write down questions, and we'll try to address some answers.
While Bill finishes collecting questions, I'll just say that we've had a number of really important issues brought up here today, and the one of honoring women and actual human beings and talking about, you know, conception and birth is very important in today's climate on reproductive rights, because there are initiatives called personhood initiatives being started in states like Mississippi and Alabama and Colorado, where the fetus is honored as a human being, and the rights of the woman are no longer valid. And so it's an important conversation, and Fran does talk about it in the book. Let's see. I'm just going to run through these for a second. But while I go through these, I'm interested from the panelists in knowing anybody who feels comfortable answering the question, where do you think that the emotional and political fervor from is coming from in this movement right now?
Well, I think it's coming from politics. I think when the issue became politicized, it came out of the realm of just ordinary people and became a political football.
And I think it's interesting that the new Pope, Francis, has said we've really got to lower the heat on this issue and on LGBT issues, and go back to the real issues of poverty and discrimination and war and peace and so on. So I think he's also saying let's depoliticize this issue and let's have the church spend its time on the issues that are most important.
So one very basic but important question that came from the audience is Roe v. Wade in jeopardy of being overturned?
I think it is. I know they're anti-choice side is preparing a case that'll go to the Supreme Court, and I think we'll lose. I don't know from nothing, but I have a friend, Lisa. What do you know?
Fran's right. There is a case being prepared, and I'm not connecting or remembering where, that they are hoping to take before the Supreme Court. What's happening right now, though, and this is where this, particularly the state action, is so important, is that Roe itself is not being attacked, but little by little, other aspects around access, around required waiting periods, around forced vaginal ultrasounds, around, you know, hearing a prescribed written lecture from your doctor about why you should not do this. These are the kinds of things that are being enacted at the state level. And so rather than going after, I think part of it is that they, to date, they have not had a case that they thought was strong enough to take to the Supreme Court to challenge Roe. So what they're doing is chipping away incrementally all around it so that it still stands, but do we have a towel somewhere?
Is there a towel in the house?
It still stands, but effectively, in reality, the right has been so restricted that it's, in many places, it might as well not stand.
I knocked that over because I was looking for a reinforcement of what Lisa was saying. There was one of the young women I talked to wanted to get an abortion. She was in one of those states. She said, we couldn't come up with the money. She and her boyfriend could not come up with the money to make the trip 300 miles or however far. So she had one severely disabled child. She was in very bad health herself. She was not able to get an abortion, and so now she has two severely disabled children. And it was because of the restrictions, the restricted access.
So considering 1 in 3 women will have an abortion in her lifetime, I think this question is really important. And it asks, how important is the role of men in supporting women's reproductive rights and justice? And the second part of that is, what forms of support from men do you panelists think will be most welcomed? So, Scotty, maybe you want to start?
Yeah, well, obviously the support of men is critical, and being well-informed, being supportive of women's rights, understanding the Roe v. Wade first trimester is a woman's decision period. The second trimester has medical engagement possible for the state to make sure it's medically well carried out. And then the third trimester, the state has some ability to regulate, but still the life and the health of the mother are central. Being sure that men are well informed, that they're supportive, that they understand how the law is developed and why. And maybe your suggestion of getting uteruses implanted is not a bad one.
So, Fran, somebody's wondering if you would be willing to tell your personal story.
I'm sorry?
If you would be willing to tell your personal story.
I think you'll have to buy the book because it's because it's too long. But in brief, it resulted from what would today be workplace rape. But in the 50s, who knew? I mean, we had no power. I've had several younger people say, well, you should have held that man accountable. I'd have been laughed out of Atlanta, Georgia. That was the cause of my unfortunate pregnancy. I had certainly not enough money or resources to find any safe option. My obstetrician said he would find me a place where I could go and spend the next 9 or 10 months and give the baby up for adoption. My father was the president of a Methodist college. It would not have been a really good time. So I found a back alley abortionist, and through the man who had impregnated me and who probably had played this game 20 times before. I mean, who knew? So I was lucky because I survived. I never told a soul until this book started. I had a sister who was like joined at the hip, and I was living with her at the time. She died without ever knowing this story. And what concerns me is having known that awful shame and guilt and everything else, and you were a criminal. And now I've got this poor, nice son that I love best of everything who has to deal with his mother being a murderer. I don't want to see that continue. I just think there has to be a better answer. Will that go for telling my story? Now you have to buy the book and read the whole thing.
That's right. Which you can buy right outside. So Fran's story is not an isolated one, and something that comes up in communications often is how do we tell a story, or how do we tell authentic stories, or allow for storytelling to be a part of the strategy? And so one question, and largely this has to do with being on the offense. So oftentimes we are reacting to what's happening in the repro movement from anti-choice, from the anti-choice side. And so a question is, how do we go on the offensive regarding repro justice without sounding offensive? And how do we build the bridges to those who are not comfortable with the anti-choice fervor, but who embrace some form of fetal justice?
It's a really good question for the rest of you. You do that.
Me?
That's a really good question.
Me? It is a good question, and I, in all honesty, don't have the answer or even, perhaps a half-baked answer. I think Fran's point about trying to encourage some sort of civil discourse is certainly valuable. Another thing that I think might help in framing a discussion or moving the discussion forward is that, and this is really riffing off of a position that NARAL's recently elected or appointed new president, Elise Hogue, talks about, is that this isn't, even though I believe firmly that it is a decision between a woman, her doctor, and her God, if that's an issue, that this is much more than that. It's a cornerstone right, because when women are not allowed to control this aspect of their lives, it affects, it has a ripple effect. It affects their abilities, perhaps, to finish their educations, their employment opportunities. That means, you know, what kinds of advancement can they make, which all affects how able they are to properly care for the children that they have. If they're lacking the resources, if they're lacking the education, they can't be involved in their communities, they can't be productive and helpful partners. And I tend to think that that argument, more artfully stated, might go a long way to reducing some of the friction between the antis and the pros. And the last thing I'll say is I don't think that anybody at NARAL or anyone I know is pro-abortion. Nobody wants this. What we want is for abortion to be safe, legal, and rare.
Can I add to that? I think that's the last point is really important, that there are people. It's frustrating to me that we within the religious realm can't take Hillary Clinton's mm-hmm. statement of safe, legal, and rare and try to build together ways to reduce the incidence of abortion where still respecting and being very clear about a woman's right to an abortion, but saying for those that really would rather not have been in that position in the first place, how can we, through good sex education, contraceptive availability, which I should have added to the point for men, make sure that you're using contraception all the time. That's really a way, I think, for us to begin to bridge that and to say, let's work together. We have different religious perspectives. Let's respect each other's religious perspectives. And by the way, mine is, and has a lot of history behind it, birth, not conception. But let's see if we can work to make the incidence of abortion rare, as Hillary Clinton asked for.
I think that's great. And to what Lisa was talking about. So the Turnaway Study, which was performed by ANSWER, Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, an organization led by researcher Tracy Wheats, is what led to AB 154 being passed, which actually examines the consequences of unintended pregnancies on women. So really thinking about, you know, what happens when you force a person to carry a pregnancy to term? What are the outcomes of that, both, you know, socially and also financially? And what are the impacts on her family and the children that already exist, and then therefore on the community? And so it's certainly a conversation I think is ripe to have amongst people who disagree fundamentally on access to abortion. And something related to that also, and this came from a couple of audience members, is how can we reconcile the fetish worship of the fetus with the political abandonment of born children as food and schooling programs are defunded and vilified by politicians?
We'd be back to my original solution. I think that's the only way to handle that.
Yeah, but you know that's the bottom of the argument is one side saying just simply thou shalt not, and then you can't have a discussion. So, but that's what the discussion is about.
If I can. Yes, please. I had a conversation several months ago with a law school classmate, former law school classmate of mine, who is pro-choice, but raised an interesting point in our discussion, and she said something to the effect of, you know, if we had the educational resources, the child care resources, the support for particularly single mothers to either continue their education, get better jobs, whatever, if we had all of that in place, she said, I might be able to say no abortion on demand. I might be able to go there. But the reality is, of course, we do not have that. And while, and I will be unabashedly partisan in this, while the Republicans basically are clamping down on abortion. Neither are they funding school programs, you know, support programs, whatever. So it's women are just getting, you know, getting it from both ends, basically. And as Fran writes, I mean, making this illegal is not going to make it go away. I mean, it's just going to make it probably more frequent and unsafe. Mm-hmm.
I want to give the Catholic Church a little credit in that they, in their consistent ethic of life perspective, which has, extends to no capital punishment on the same basis, they've generally historically done quite a good job at looking at providing facilities for early birth, for opportunities for women who do have children. That they might have wanted to abort, and so on. So it's critical, obviously, that we think of all of human life, and also religiously, historically, there's been precedence for existing life versus potential life when it comes to the life and the health of the mother. So if even you use a legal self-defense argument, you have two, you know, lives that you consider are vying with each other. If the life and health of the mother is to be sacrificed for fetal life, that religiously has not been permissible historically in virtually any tradition.
So I will be the first to admit throughout the reproductive health rights and justice frameworks, we are not great about talking about all of the options that people have when considering whether or not to parent a child. And so a question came about adoption. So when looking at the abortion issue, the issue of adoption is tangentially important. If a woman is to consider adoption, what infrastructure is available, and is that being expanded?
I don't know. I think when people say to me, abortion is wrong, a baby, once the conception happens, the baby should arrive, and you can always... there are all these people that want to adopt babies. All these people who want to adopt babies are not necessarily wanting to adopt severely disabled babies or drug-addicted babies. So I don't think you can
children
pair...
Children of color.
That's right.
Or children of color. So, yeah, I don't think you can work the abortion adoption issue. I think that is... not just overly simplistic, but not quite workable. I wish it were.
Loretta Ross, who's the former executive director of Sister Song, Women of Color organization based in Atlanta, talks a lot about the assumption from, you know, anti-choice people that adoption is always a viable opportunity for people. And there was an interesting story that I think is going to go viral in the next couple of days that I read yesterday about a 16-year-old boy named Davion who's living
yes.
in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It will break your heart if you read it, but... he went to it. He's been in and out of foster care his entire life, and he went to a church, and he got up. He said he read something about, you know, God helps people who help themselves. So he got up in the stand, and he said, "I'm looking for a family. Will somebody, anybody, white, black, young, old, I don't care who you are, please adopt me." And the story is excellently written, a great narrative, but went on to talk about how, you know, lots of, you know, kids of color are living in foster care, and there was a really interesting story on NPR about it being really inexpensive to adopt a black baby, which, you know, so it just, there's a lot of questions around whether or not adoption is viable. And I think the assumption or the, you know, the idea is just thrown out there very whimsically oftentimes when people say, well, you can just give it up for adoption, when in fact that's not necessarily always true for everybody.
Loretta is in the book, and and I'm a fan of hers. And if you read about the work she does, it's tough. And it's remarkable.
Can I just
yes,
say one thing?
Course.
I don't know very much about the status of the adoption system in the United States now, but I would echo what Chanel said, that it seems to me, and there are many of you in the audience who might know this better than I, that pre-Roe there were options available. But most of the time what was happening is that women were going to Mexico or Sweden or someplace else, and those babies were being given up, but certainly in the case of Sweden, in a country that has vastly superior social support networks than the United States does. Now, Mexico is a different story, but the people who went away, their children were, or the babies were not then, they did not become part of the American adoption system. And so some of the burden was taken off, I guess, is what I'm trying to get to.
And I have to interject one other thing. A lot of the people who went away because they could not get safe abortions here. And one of the people who helped them go away is Pat McGinnis. And I didn't know she was even still on the planet, but there she is. Raise her hand, Pat. Because if those of you who follow my Facebook page know that Pat showed up at a reading in Oakland Monday, and I was able to say, in the 60s, if you were pregnant and desperate in Chicago, you looked for Jane. If you were pregnant and desperate in the Bay Area, you looked for Pat McGinnis. And here she is, and thank you. I just had to get that in. Okay. That's all.
I think this question is going to be great for you, Lisa. Well, it's not quite a question as much as it is a statement, which I think is important to bring up. As a pro-choice woman, I am also pro-life. We can be both. We need to reframe this discussion. So I guess, you know, to frame it as a question, how can we reframe this discussion around, you know, being both pro-choice and pro-life?
Well, I think that, again, going back to Hillary Clinton, safe, legal, and rare is critical. And recognizing and starting to dialogue about the fact that, you know, I think there's this conception out there that there are a whole lot of women out there who use abortion as birth control. And I believe the statistics show that of all of the services that Planned Parenthood offers, only 3% of their services are abortion services. So I think that by starting to dialogue about how no one is really anti-life, but rather in favor of having the right to make choices that meet the woman's individual needs is how to start this. That's...
So this is really interesting. Why can't we talk about overpopulation and the very survival of the planet? We are in a human man-made climate crisis. Why do we always have to say abortion is being safe and rare? One thing I will say in regards to talking about overpopulation is that the overpopulation of the planet is being blamed on black and brown bodies in developing countries and here in the United States. We don't often think about the impact of large corporations on the environment when we're considering environmental degradation, which is, it's very easy to point the finger at women living in developing countries who don't have access to contraception, comprehensive sex education, abortion, or other opportunities to be able to determine the way that their life is going to go. And so Sister Song also did some great work on that. Also, Young Women United in Albuquerque is doing great work on talking about environmental justice and the ways in which we can help people curb their fertility if they want it, but also ensuring that we're talking very openly and having a dialogue about the implications of corporate greed on the environment, which also is severe to what we're experiencing now. But does anybody else want to?
No, I just want to put you on a pedestal and let you make your speech. I think you could get some points across. No, all I can say is you're right.
Do we know, anybody on the panel, what percent of women do not have access to abortion since they do not have health care?
Someone does. I don't. I'm looking at my friend Noni Green. Not off the top of my head. I could get that number, but I don't know. What I do know is true is that anyone who is covered by the federal government insurance program, does not have abortion care, does not have birth control covered, and that's thanks to the Hyde Amendment, 1976. So that's a huge number of women right there. Who are not able to access those services. And part of what was behind the recent display of, as a friend of mine says, third grade behavior in Washington in the last 3 weeks, one of the key provisions that I don't want to use the term, but that was at stake in the whole push to try and basically gut Obamacare was the issue of coverage for birth control, coverage for abortions, and whether or not businesses could effectively invoke a conscience clause argument with respect to whether or not their internal health insurance programs would cover abortion and birth control for women. I actually, these are called conscience clauses. I refer to them as refusal clauses. But
when you add to that, I think this is a statistical fact, 87% of the counties in the United States have no abortion access. Excuse me.
No, and I was just going to add to it what's happening with religious institutions, hospitals, and colleges and universities saying that we're not going to provide those services, even for people who are not who don't hold that belief. And so to me, it's another matter of religious freedom. Let's protect the religious freedom of people who do want those services and look at it very differently religiously.
The ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project is doing some work around that as well. And Henry Hyde is probably rolling over in his grave about AB 154 being passed. I'll just smile to that. I'll be very excited. And there are only 15 states nationwide that actually allow Medicaid to cover abortion. California is one of them. Grateful for that. But, you know, there is some progress happening on the ground with grassroots activists to repeal the Hyde Amendment. So that's currently happening in a very large capacity right now. Fingers crossed that we will be successful in that in the next 15 to 20 years. So something that came up is earlier I mentioned the justice framework. And so there are three frameworks that aim to help in the reproductive movement, and that's reproductive rights, health, and justice. And sometimes we are not always, you know, having conversations with each other. And so, Fran, I think this is directed at you, but it says, you know, we've talked about the importance of uniting as many of us, and I'm assuming us as pro-choice folks, as possible to work together for reproductive health rights and justice. As a supporter of the Trust Women Silver Ribbon campaign, I'm interested to hear how the panel recommends how we build the power and unite together as we need to kind of move forward.
That's a really tough one because I talk about this all the time, how the anti-choice forces who have usurped the pro-life term, which I resent because I feel very pro-life myself, but they speak with one voice, and there are so many voices on the other side. And Lisa and I were talking about this yesterday because, in fact, a lot of these voices have a different area. Planned Parenthood, for one, does a million things besides abortion, but they have gotten pegged as the target for so much of the vitriol. And so I wish there were a magic way to unite all the different voices for choice. We didn't figure that out yesterday. Have you figured it out yet, Lisa?
We've certainly got some work to do. And I will say, as a young person, millennials are working diligently to help the justice fight and also the rights fight and to ensure that we're inclusive in this movement. And it can be very difficult to do that sometimes when, you know, I think sometimes the reason why anti-choice people have such an easy time, you know, really gaining momentum is because their language is easy, right? I mean, it's a stump conversation. Abortion is murder because the Bible says so. Our discussions are much more complex, and especially when you take into issues, I'm just going to blow your mind here for a minute, thinking of trans inclusion with abortion. So there are, you know, trans men living in this country who need access to abortion. I mean, think about the talking points for that. You know, so we've got to dig a little bit deeper sometimes, and it can be a little bit more difficult for us. But there are lots of organizations here in the Bay Area working from all those perspectives. As I mentioned, ANSWER is working from a health perspective. You've got Access Women's Health Justice, who is the local abortion fund in Oakland, working from a justice perspective. And then, you know, obviously got the ACLU, NARAL, working from a choice and rights perspective. So let's see. got lots of great questions here. We may not get to them all. And for those of you who did not print and I can't read your handwriting, we definitely won't get to yours. Sorry about that. So somebody's wondering if the personhood bills, which, as I mentioned earlier, define life as beginning as at conception, have any chance of passing. I will just say that Mississippi did fail last year, but they did compromise because there was a bad voting rights bill that did pass requiring a legal form of identification to be had in Mississippi. So sometimes the social justice issues intersect, and so while the personhood did not pass, some people did lose their access to voting because they can't get identification. But I'm wondering if anybody in the panel has any idea if...
Well, I know that this issue is coming up in Colorado again for the fourth time, I believe, and it has failed the previous three times. And I don't, off the top of my head, know where else there are measures currently going forward, but I would be pretty sure that somewhere amongst the 307 that have been proposed in the states, there are more.
Great, thank you. So somebody's wondering where the artificial insemination industry fits into all of this, overpopulation, government funding, et cetera.
I don't know, but I had an interesting Monday night. I was drinking tea across the street from Great Good Place for Books, which is a great good place in Oakland. And as I left, and there were just a couple of us there, but as I left, a friend of mine identified me as the famous author who was speaking across the street, and I held up the book. I mean, you do this all the time. And he said, and this lovely young man who had been bringing me honey and lemon and tea and all that stuff that I knock off, said, well, you know, there ought to be some laws, too, about the men, because my girlfriend had an abortion. She didn't tell me. And I said, uh-huh, that ought to be part of the conversation, because there are a lot of, I've got a whole chapter, in fact, on husbands and lovers, and it's remarkable how it's not always just the woman who is involved. There is usually a man.
I think we can deepen the conversation around male reproductive rights. I certainly think that the time is right for that. But as I mentioned, our conversations are really nuanced, and it gets a little bit difficult to include everything. So are there, somebody's wondering, still fake abortion clinics, so the
crisis pregnancy centers
in San Francisco or the Bay Area? Do we know?
Yes. There are several right here in San Francisco. There are some down the peninsula. And there are in parts of the state that are more rural, less access or whatever, that's predominantly what exists as opposed to legitimate clinics. And these are the places, for those of you who don't know, where you'll see a billboard or something on a bus kiosk that says, you know, pregnant, need help, not always a CPC, crisis pregnancy center, but very often. And San Francisco is the second city in the country behind Austin to have recently enacted essentially a truth in advertising statute about crisis pregnancy centers. It doesn't pass moral judgment, doesn't say good, bad, whatever. It sets some standards as to what people can say, must say, so forth.
Scotty, I think this is a great question for you. Of the experts cited as authorities on the question of when life begins, how many were women?
Zero. And
how can religious moderates distance and contain the violent actions some use to oppose abortion?
Well, I think, as I've mentioned before, we've got to come together religiously and say there are ways for us to work across all of these differences to promote safe and legal and rare abortion. And how can we do that? And we can't just stop at the door and say, somebody's pro-choice and somebody's pro-life, and that's the end of it. But there are ways for us to talk, and I think one of the ways is to talk about inter-religious understanding, that people have very different, deeply held convictions about the nature of life and the nature of personhood. And that needs to be respected in a country where we have a First Amendment that respects free exercise of religion, and where we need to defend that. So I can't say we're doing a great job of this, but there are groups like the Lutheran Women's Caucus that has been working hard on this for 20, 25 years to try to create interfaith dialogue. So we need to do that.
Thank you. So the last question we're going to take today is, what is the best way to get involved and help the cause? And I will start by saying you can donate to the ACLU, to Stanford, NARAL, or you can buy Fran's book. It's always a great way. But also here in the Bay Area, in Oakland, the Access Women's Health Justice is the local abortion fund. They do fund abortion, but they do help provide funding for women in need of abortions, but also they do practical services. So if you can host a woman at your house overnight, oftentimes because geography can be an issue, they need to drive upwards of 300 miles to access an abortion clinic, or you can drive her there or sit with her. And there are also a number of reproductive health rights and justice organizations you can volunteer for. If you're interested in that, you can talk to me after, and I think that other panelists will be available after. And there's also funds, no matter where you live, funds all around the country. I am on the board of the National Network of Abortion Funds, who help support 100 funds all over the country to provide abortion funds to women and families in need. Suggestions?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of others. We had a question earlier about Trust Women Silver Ribbon Campaign, and there are some folks working for an umbrella solution to try to, not a solution, but at least to try to bring together a stronger voice. And I see Bill getting ready to bang the gavel. Oh, if he had a gavel, he would bang the gavel. So I'm going to read one closing paragraph here, because this is what the hope of the book is. These stark facts belong to the past and the present. Tragedies versus desperate women. Compassionate care versus humiliation or no care at all. Womb versus soul, baby killer versus woman hater. As long as one side only shouts at the other, the same battles will be waged into the future, because abortion is not going to disappear. What if common ground could be sought? Mutual respect, healthy families, better understanding of different points of view. No one wants to see increased numbers of unwanted children or sick and maimed women. Most want women to have at least some degree of autonomy, and the poor to have some protection. Perhaps the ample common ground might even support movement toward a stronger, healthier country, and the history of brutality won't repeat itself. One can hope.
We've been listening to a panel discussion on women at risk, What's Ahead for Reproductive Rights, organized by Fran Johns, moderated by Chanel Matthews, with contributions from Lisa Lindeleff and Scotty McLennan. We thank them for their comments today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.